This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. There are quite a lot of people who are excited about Donald Trump's inauguration this Friday. And believe it or not, among them are several leaders in the Middle East. In our first segment, we're going to talk with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about why leaders from Israel and Egypt and Libya and other nations in that region are optimistic about a Trump presidency. Japan's prime minister belongs to a group called Nippon Kaigi, and so does most of his cabinet and a majority of Japan's parliament and many other high-ranking officials in politics, the military, education, and elsewhere in Japanese society. What does this group stand for? What are its beliefs? And what does it tell us about the direction and the future of Japan? The answers to those questions are very concerning. We're going to talk with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about this very fascinating subject. Medicine is big business, and pharmaceutical companies make billions of dollars supplying drugs to help people with all kinds of ailments. Well, sadly, this also feeds greed in ways that are not good for our health at all. These drug makers have become very good at manufacturing new types of diseases, disorders, and illnesses in order to sell people on new drugs. It's a practice that some experts are calling disease mongering. We're going to talk with nutritionist Jörg Mardian about how to avoid falling for these traps. And I'll conclude the program with an ancient but timeless and terrific checklist of how to grow in your leadership. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Donald Trump will be inaugurated as America's president on Friday. His presidency is going to mark a significant change in American policy in a lot of ways, and nations around the world are trying to figure out just what that change will look like, how significant it will be. President-elect Trump has made some statements about how he's going to deal with Israel and the Middle East that has a lot of leaders in that region voicing optimism about the future. To talk about why and whether or not that optimism is warranted, we have Brent Noctegal via Skype from our office in Jerusalem. Hello, Brent.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Very well, thank you.
So let's start by talking about what may be the most obvious nation in the region, Israel. Obviously, Donald Trump is viewed as a whole lot more pro-Israel than his predecessor. How are Israelis taking this upcoming inauguration?
I think a lot of Israelis are taking the kind of the standpoint that a lot of people are, is wait and see whether Mr. Trump is going to be as pro-Israel as he has said he is going to be. I was just actually in a taxi today going to the American consulate here in Jerusalem just to update a passport. And even the taxi driver was talking about Donald Trump and whether he's going to move the embassy there and whether that's going to be a good move for Israel. And I think a lot of, at least the Jerusalemites, believe that America having their embassy in the capital of Israel seems like a great idea. So they, I would say Israel, for the most part, they're excited about a Trump presidency. They're excited about somebody on the international stage that is actually going to voice support for them in the face of a lot of other world public opinion against Israel. So Israelis themselves are pretty excited. And we can even see some other nations that are becoming more pro-Israel, it seems, because Trump is pro-Israel. And them wanting to do probably future business deals with a Trump presidency in America and realizing if they're so anti-Israel, then that might not be a good thing for them in the long run. So we're actually seeing other nations change their tune to Israel as well.
So give us some examples of what you're talking about there.
Well, the most recent example is just what's happened over the past couple of days. Our listeners knew about the peace conference that took place on Sunday, just outside of Paris, and it was about Middle Eastern peace between the Palestinians and Israelis, except the Palestinians and the Israelis weren't there. At the end of that, there was a declaration or a statement that we, these international countries, these nations believe that there should be a commitment to the two-state solution. But what we saw the day after on Monday was the EU ministers getting together and trying to formally adopt that statement from that Paris Peace Conference for the EU, saying this is our position. And yet we had a number of nations that stood up to the French in particular that wanted to push this through, that being the Brits and also some Balkan states. And the Jerusalem Post was reporting yesterday that the reason that they balked is because they wanted to get off on the right foot with Donald Trump once he comes into office, and they want a friendly ally in the United States. And so they're aligning their foreign policy towards Israel because of Trump's foreign policy towards Israel.
What are the indications, just briefly, that Trump has given as far as what his policy toward Israel might be? Obviously, we had that very anti-Israel resolution passed by the Security Council. Maybe how he's going to handle that, and just what his administration is going to look like in terms of the personnel that it would have dealing with Israel.
Okay, so a number of things there. In his response to this UN resolution 2334 that was passed at the end of December, he was pretty livid about that, and he thought that it was a terrible thing for America to do, to accept this resolution. And he gave an interview to the Times of London and also Bild over the weekend. And I'm just going to quote what they said, that Trump said about that. He said, "The problem I have," this is with the resolution, "is that it makes it a tougher deal for me to negotiate because the Palestinians are given so much." And that, just that comment alone, "the Palestinians are given so much," flies in the face of just the standpoint of the rest of the world that believe the Palestinians aren't given enough. Well, he says they are given so much. And he said, even though it's not legally binding, this UN resolution, it's psychologically binding. And he's on to a point here. And he says, "it makes it much tougher for me to negotiate because," he said, "you understand that? Because people are giving away chips. They're giving away all these chips. It's psychologically binding on the Palestinians now because they believe they're entitled to East Jerusalem. It's not something that can be negotiated. So it deteriorates the negotiating position of Israel." And Mr. Trump says he wants a peace deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis under his watch. And so he believes it's tougher for him to make a deal now because the international community just gave away something that he could have used as a bargaining chip in the future. Now, looking towards the personnel that he's going to use in those interviews, he did say that he is likely going to tap his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. He is the husband to Ivanka, I believe, and he is Jewish. Well, he's actually a practicing Jew. So he believes that he is a natural talent, and he knows a lot of the people involved in the Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations. So he's going to use him as his point man when it comes to brokering Middle Eastern peace.
But he is talking about how the moves that President Obama has made just recently do constrain him, and that it does limit the amount of change that we might be expecting, maybe tamping down expectations a little bit about what he's going to be able to accomplish.
Well, it's certainly making it harder for him to get a deal. When you're about to buy a car, you don't tell them how much money you're willing to pay because your maximum amount, because it takes away from your bargaining position. You know, right. If you're willing to give half of Jerusalem over to the Palestinians, you don't say that at the start, because then they're going to want more than half of Jerusalem through that process. And Israel is running out of concessions to give here to negotiate peace.
Well, and the whole thing is predicated on the idea that they actually have a good faith peace partner, negotiation partner here. And it seems like Donald Trump has accepted that premise as a foundational notion behind the entire region here.
He must have accepted that they would be willing to accept some type of deal. And I think that's probably, I don't like to assume naivety on the case of somebody that knows a lot more about most things than I do. And Mr. Trump, I'm sure he does. But I don't know if he's seen the Palestinian mindset up close, where for time after time, they have been offered by previous Israeli governments, East Jerusalem. They have been offered the West Bank. They have been offered at least twice in the recent history those things, and yet Palestinian leadership has not accepted a deal. So I don't know. He did write the book, but whether he can get a deal would be another story. And I think it's going to be much more difficult than he actually realizes.
Well, let's go ahead and move on to some other nations in the region and how a Donald Trump presidency would affect these other nations, how they're responding, any sense of his the effect that he would have on Egypt.
The Wall Street Journal wrote an interesting piece, or Yaroslav Trofimov, for the Wall Street Journal on Monday, and it's entitled, "In Middle East, Leaders Want Donald Trump to Be Their Friend." And I think it brings out a very interesting point, and this is just the first sentence. It says, "It's hard to find a Middle Eastern official betraying signs of anxiety over what President-elect Donald Trump will do once in office. From Egypt to Turkey to Saudi Arabia and to unsurprisingly Israel, government leaders delight in discussing what an improvement the Trump presidency is likely to be over President Barack Obama's record in office." And the reason that they express this is because Mr. Trump has been so vague on his Middle Eastern policy that they're just going to wait and see as well. And they're hoping for the best. And
everybody has interpreted what statements he's made in as the best possible scenario to serve their own interests.
Right, because he has said a lot of things. I think there's probably one nation in the Middle East, Iran, that knows that they're not going to get a good deal from Mr. Trump, it seems. But everyone else seems pretty positive about what they could get out of the United States president. I think the big thing here is it does show that while the Middle Eastern relationships between America and Middle Eastern countries have suffered over the past 8 years, Middle Eastern nations believe that can be rectified. They believe that there is coming a huge change when Mr. Trump takes the Oval Office, and that they each do stand to benefit.
Well, that's really interesting. American power, I mean, we've talked a lot, and we talk a lot about just all of the signs of the decline in American power. And yet there is the vestiges of the fact that it is still preponderantly powerful, that America is the leading player in a lot of ways. It's a matter of the fact that it hasn't been used and exercised appropriately, but there seems to be a lot of hope that it would be used in a way that would benefit the region. And Donald Trump presidency at least poses the promise of that happening.
Yeah, for sure. We talk a lot, like you said, about America's loss of power, and that is mostly because of a lack of will to use it. Mm-hmm. That's what the prophecy is about, that I'm going to break your pride in your power. You're still going to have power if you would use it, but you don't use it. And Mr. Trump, it seems, is willing to use it. And Middle Eastern nations realize that, hey, if you have an America coming back to the Middle East, having a robust foreign policy in the Middle East, they want to get a part of it. That could really benefit their countries.
So let's just do a little bit of a lightning round here. If we talk about some of these nations, I mentioned Egypt. Maybe you could give us some details of any indications of what they're thinking or what Donald Trump has tipped his hand to suggest.
Well, the current leader of Egypt, Mr. el-Sisi, he obviously is an anti-Islamist. He's in power because he ousted the Muslim Brotherhood from power inside Egypt. And if we've heard what Mr. Trump, a lot of his rhetoric leading up to the election in the United States, it wasn't pro-Islamic. He was willing to call out Islamic terrorism, that type of thing. So there is a natural alignment there. Also, what we saw going back to this UN Security Council resolution is that Egypt was actually the one that originally wrote the text, at least part of the text, and they put that forward. But in the day before it was meant to go to vote, Egypt delayed it. They withdrew that text and they said, "We are not going to be the ones that put this forward." And behind the scenes, what had happened was Donald Trump had called up el-Sisi had called up Egypt and said, this isn't going to be good for you. And Egypt withdrew it. And then you had New Zealand, another couple of lackey countries, they took up the mantle there of that deal. So you can see that there is already an alignment between Sisi and Trump because of that. And I mean, if you look back to America's foreign policy of the past, what stabilized the Middle East? It was a strong relationship with Israel and Egypt, but that was backed by a strong relationship between Egypt and America as well when Mubarak was in power, because he was such a strong man. And Sisi is after the mold of Mubarak, and Mr. Trump would like to follow in those footsteps in supporting him against the Islamist rise.
What do you think of Libya?
Right now, it's the basket case of North Africa. Could go many different ways. Two rivaling governments. There have been a number of reports in the last week or so, or articles written, that is hoping that there is a Trump that comes in and finds a solution to the crisis in Libya, potentially working with both the Russians and the Europeans to try and broker some type of government that'll work coming out of Libya.
All right. Well, clearly have a lot more to say on this subject, Brent. I'm sure you're going to have to write an article about this. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about Donald Trump's Middle Eastern policy, the effect that his presidency is going to have on that region. And if you watch for thetrumpet.com, surely you'll be able to receive more insights from our man Brent Noctegal. We appreciate it, Brent.
No problem. Thanks for having me on the show.
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Imagine if Germany elected a leader who was a member of a radical nationalist group that believed that Germany did nothing wrong in World War II, believed that the accounts of Germans massacring Jews were exaggerated or even fabricated. And what if this group's stated goal was to return Germany to its World War II era glory? Well, believe it or not, this is essentially what is happening in Japan today. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is a member of the Nippon Kaigi, a secretive group that we are beginning to learn more about in recent years. To tell us about this group and what it says about Japan's leadership and its future, we have Jeremiah Jacques here. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
So let's start by talking about just how much this group is involved in Japanese politics. The prime minister is in it, but he's not the only one.
No, he's not. Actually, of the 19 members in the Japanese cabinet, 10 of them also belong to this shadowy nationalist group. And that includes, the deputy prime minister, the minister of defense, the minister of foreign affairs, the minister of education, the minister of health, the minister of reconstruction, and also Mr. Abe's chief cabinet secretary. Then on top of that, you've got of the 480 members of Japan's parliament, which is called the Diet, 289 of them are members of this group. So it's incredibly, it has quite a broad reach into the highest echelons of all kinds of different levels of government. And then besides those official government representatives, there are also a lot of renowned academics and authors. There are media moguls, leading Shinto priests are members of the group, and also titans of industry, high-ranking diplomats and military officers, both present and former. And then just all kinds of other very influential and powerful people.
So it really tends to be more of the people of influence in Japan. This isn't a huge group. It's not a widespread group. There's not a lot of maybe more of the common citizenry that's part of it, but it's definitely deeply entrenched within the leadership of the country.
That's right. There are actually only 38,000 total members, which is just a, you know, a tiny fraction of a percent of Japan's population, but it is an elitist group. It's a group that pretty much only very influential, important people would even be eligible for membership in.
So tell us about the history of the group. How was it founded? What can we learn about it just from its origins?
Sure. Yeah, the Nippon Kaigi actually only started with that name in 1997, but its forerunner groups had been around for decades longer than that. In 1997, two groups that were nationalistic and who wanted to restore Japan to that World War II era glory and to emperor worship and things like that, in 97, two of them merged together, and then they became Nippon Kaigi. But those groups had actually been around since the early 70s. At least one of them had been. And they grew out of basically state Shintoism, which was the religion of Japan during its the lead up to World War II and during World War II. State Shinto played a huge role in that fanaticism that we think of when we think back on Japanese militarism during the war. They believed that their Emperor Hirohito, was a god, an actual divinity who is destined to rule the whole world. The Shinto religion also taught them that Japanese people in general were a superior race that were destined to rule the whole world, just sort of a rung below their emperor there. And so it instilled this fanaticism that really caused the Japanese military machine to be more ruthless, I think, than almost any that the world had seen. And so in the 70s, some of these people who were upset about the outcome of the war, some of the people who were resentful about the fact that America came in there in 1945 and said, from now on, this is a pacifist country. From now on, Shinto is not the state religion. And they also, the Americans and the other allied forces told Emperor Hirohito, they let him stay on as emperor, but he was basically stripped of a lot of his powers, and he did have to publicly renounce his divinity. He had to go on the radio and say, you know, I'm not a god. So anyway, most of the people in the wake of Japan's defeat, most of the Japanese accepted the outcome of the war. But not everyone did. Mm-hmm. Not everyone was happy about that.
Well, and I wonder if there would even be some people who would have considered the emperor's statement to be false or something that was kind of spoken under duress and may have continued to believe that.
I think that's very likely. And so those who were resentful about the outcome of the war, they were the ones who basically formed this group in the early 70s that was the forerunner to Nippon Kaigi, which, you know, later in the 90s fused with that other group. So it was born of state Shinto, and it was also born of resentment. You know, it's born, this movement is born of just those who feel that Japan was not treated fairly in the war and in the aftermath of that war. So it has some fairly dangerous ideology, I think, that is really its very foundation.
So you're describing, say, the ideology and the beliefs of those groups that preceded Nippon Kaigi. How much do we have a sense of the group today? How much of that it has actually retained, or to what level and extreme it's retained those kinds of views? And maybe you could just give us some more ideas of what we actually know that the Nippon Kaigi believes.
Sure. Yeah, there was actually a U.S. Congressional Research Service report very recently published, and I'll read a short quote from that. It says, the Nippon Kaigi believes that Tokyo War Crimes Tribunals were illegitimate. They believe that the massacre of Nanking was either exaggerated or fabricated, and they believe that Japan should be applauded for liberating much of East Asia during World War II. And then there's also an Economist report that was sort of an in-depth analysis, investigative journalism. And I'll read a quote from that, which I think does a good job of just laying out the group's goals. To applaud Japan's wartime liberation of East Asia from Western colonialism, to rebuild the armed forces, to inculcate patriotism among students brainwashed by left-wing teachers, and to revere the emperor as he was worshipped in the good old days before the war.
So really, the religious elements are still there.
It's a huge part of it. I don't think that the Japanese militarism would have been such a force to be reckoned with without that religious component. Mm-hmm. And so now those who are in favor of sort of resurrecting that same kind of militarism, they're not straying from the formula. You know, they see the need to leave religion at the foundation.
So you used the word shadowy when you described the group earlier in the interview. Why is this group received so little attention to now, and why are we actually starting to learn more about it more recently?
Well, I've actually heard this name, Nippon Kaigi, pop up a few times over the years, and I dismissed it as something sort of conspiratorial. It always just seemed a little bit like a conspiracy theory for quite a long time. But there was a book published in the middle of last year. This was by Tomatsu Sugano, and it's called A Study on the Japanese Conference. And this is...
Japanese Conference is the literal translation of Nippon Kaigi.
Right, yes. Nippon Kaigi is Japanese Conference. So this book is just a study on the group. And since its release, the book has sold more than 153,000 copies, which made it a surprise bestseller. And it also brought the group kind of, it brought its vast influence out of the shadows. So since that book was published, suddenly it looks like, you know, this is not a conspiracy theory. If you just look at the membership of the Japanese cabinet, for example, you see, wow, more than half of the most powerful people in the country, including Prime Minister Shinzo Abe himself, are part of this group. It just, you know, little by little, you see this is actually, it's a group that really does wield quite a bit of influence.
And so that was released, and then earlier you mentioned, was it a congressional report, something the U.S. government has acknowledged its existence, and they're even detailing some of the beliefs of this group. So that would be further evidence.
That's right. Yes. So beyond just the book that was written by this Japanese gentleman, there was the congressional report. And then since then, publications such as The Daily Beast and The Economist and others have acknowledged that Nippon Kaigi is an actual a threat, I think, in some ways, to post-war pacifism that has helped Japan achieve so much prosperity in the time since the war ended.
Now, Shinzo Abe, he's obviously one that has been associated with a more nationalistic ideology, and a lot of people have pinned that on him, and maybe this is giving us a little more insight into just how extensive that type of thinking is within the elite level within Japan in politics and other leadership positions. Maybe you could just give us an idea of how much influence this group has, small as it is, some of the accomplishments and achievements that the group has managed to score.
Sure. Yes, their vast influence is just now being brought out of the shadows, I think. But if you look back over the last decade especially, it's clear that they have made some major accomplishments. The first of those came in 2006 when Nippon Kaigi collected about 3.6 million signatures that demanded reforms to Japan's educational system. Basically, they said, we need to stop teaching Japanese history in a way that makes Japanese students ashamed of it, and instead teach it in a way that cultivates patriotism and even a bit of nationalism. They're still working more toward making the education as more nationalistic, but they did win a major victory there in 2006. So that passed some very controversial legislation when they collected those signatures. Then right around the same time, they also had the birthday of Emperor Hirohito made an official national holiday. Hirohito's role in World War II and in the Nanking Massacre, it's the subject of a lot of debate.
Just a brief description of the Nanking Massacre, please.
Nanking Massacre was, that was the capital of China at the time. And basically when the Japanese soldiers went in there, they were very brutal in massacring. Historians estimate between 200,000 and 300,000 civilians, so not even soldiers. And the brutality with which they massacred them was just too atrocious to even think about, really. There is a lot of controversy. The Japanese say this was, the hardliner Japanese, the Nippon Kagi and others like that, they say this was never happened, or if it did, it was a tiny little thing that's normal in war. The Chinese, who are the victims of it, say this was one of the biggest atrocities that's ever been committed against any group in the history of mankind. So the actual facts might lie somewhere in the middle in terms of the numbers who were killed, but I think probably if you weighed all that, you would still think that it was about 200,000 civilians who were just very brutally slaughtered, including women and children.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Hirohito, it's likely that he was involved with things like that. And so the fact that they were able to make his birthday a national holiday, it wouldn't quite be on par with Germany making Hitler's birthday a holiday, but those in China say it is on par with that.
Mm.
So it's... That was quite an accomplishment for their point of view. They also were instrumental in helping Mr. Abe come back into power in 2012 after he had sort of an ignominious resignation in 2007. They also, the Nippon Kagi was able to reinstitute the imperial calendar in Japan, which replaced the Western calendar.
So what is your sense, just briefly, of considering how extensive the influence of this group is in Japanese politics, of how this would affect Japan's future, what we might see from Japan in the future because of this, or what this illuminates about that?
Well, that's a great question. I think the future looks, it looks like they are definitely marching back toward militarism. They are abandoning pacifism. If you think back to 2015, when the Japanese parliament reinterpreted Japan's constitution to say they do have a right to collective self-defense, that was the Nippon Kagi was working behind the scenes to make that happen. And that was a huge victory. They were successful in reinterpreting the constitution. The diplomat and other analysts called that the biggest event of 2015, the most important event. So I think going forward, we can expect more reinterpreting or even flat out amending of Japan's constitution, which will just open the door for a full-fledged military normalization, possibly even the development of nuclear weapons. But I think that the future, if this group stays in power, it looks like they'll be able to basically leave that pacifist constitution behind.
It's a fascinating subject. We really appreciate you studying into that and bringing that to us. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about Japan's nationalistic Nippon Kaigi. He's written an article on this subject. It's slated to go on the next print edition of the Trumpet magazine. You can watch for it online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Jeremiah.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Medicine is big business. If you're sick, there's a pill for that. In fact, pharmaceutical companies have become pretty good at labeling new diseases, even manufacturing new types of illnesses in order to sell people on new drugs. It's a practice that some experts are calling disease mongering. To tell us about this, we have nutritionist and personal trainer Jorg Mardian from his office in British Columbia. Hello, Jorg.
Great to be here.
So disease mongering, this is a term that probably most of us aren't familiar with. Maybe you can just give us a more in-depth description of what we're talking about here.
Oh, sure. It does sound like a strange term, doesn't it? Especially when we're talking about the supposed sacred cow of medicine. Really, disease mongering means it's a practice of creating diseases to market new drugs. And it begins on the pharmaceutical end, of course, with these companies. And there's a lot of consumer advertising and regular medical checkups that work in conjunction to cause people to worry about previously non-existent problems. So really what it does is it preys upon fears and insecurities of patients with the predictable result that there's going to be more drugs sold. So that in a nutshell, that's what disease mongering is.
Could you give us some examples of this? Like I'm just thinking of say if they find something like something that kind of sounds like a disease. Maybe it's just a general problem that people have. Maybe it's social issue or something like that. But if you put a label on it that it's this particular disorder, suddenly you think, oh, well, yeah. And then they have something that's going to help you with that. Can you just give us some specific examples of what you'd be talking about?
Well, sure. And in context, when we talk about specific disorders, it kind of sounds like they fall upon them, they find them, and they treat them. Unfortunately, that's not always the case. When we're looking at pharmaceuticals, a lot of that hinges upon profit. So within the process of creating drugs, sometimes pharmaceuticals are created with specific physiological effects that aren't very helpful to a current illness. However, the cost of creating and manufacturing a drug is very high. And if it's greater than the return on investment, the pharmaceuticals are going to have to look to co-opt a new disease for that. And there are, you know, this is proven. Disease branding is one way to do that. And it really works for three types of conditions. One is when you destigmatize a shameful condition, let's say incontinence. That was later rebranded as overactive bladder. So incontinence suggests a problem for the elderly, while an overactive bladder simply means more frequent trips to the bathroom. Well, that little switch on words created $3 billion in sales through 2015.
Wow.
Another candidate for branding is underdiagnosed conditions. So a famous example is with the antidepressant Paxil, which was always for the treatment of social anxiety disorder. A devastating condition previously known as shyness, for which there were only about 50 social media references in 1997. So get this, 50 media references for social anxiety disorder. In 1999, there were 1 billion references
right.
to this disease, new disease. So it's a marketing campaign that brought up these references. And today, social anxiety disorder, through today, is described as the third most common mental illness. So the third tactic, of course, is the fabricating disorders is through repackaging a drug facing patent expiry. So an example of this is Prozac, the popular antidepressant. So when drug giant Eli Lilly invented premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD, which was just an extension of PMS. Basically, it's the same thing, except it's supposed to be bigger symptoms. Uh-huh. They labeled it a tragic disease. Again, there's a lot of marketing that goes in it. And they offered another drug, they said, called Seraphim, which really was the same drug, repackaged Prozac, that the patent expiry left. Same pill, different color, same ingredients, same dosage, yet a different name.
It's treating a different disease. Yeah. Yeah, that's remarkable. So, and I imagine that the numbers on these other two that you're talking about are probably just as profitable for the pharmaceuticals as the drug to treat shyness.
Absolutely. We're always talking about billions. We're not talking about millions. Most times these big ones with a disorder that is well known, that is in the public psyche, well accepted, we're talking billions and billions of dollars.
So I imagine that we have listeners right now, maybe there are some people who have been diagnosed with, what was the clinical name for shyness?
Social anxiety disorder.
Right. So we have listeners who maybe have social anxiety disorder. And they're saying, well, now, wait a minute, you're telling me that this condition that I've been diagnosed, this is a legitimate condition, I'm taking this drug, it's helping me with it, that this is all a big boondoggle.
Well, a lot of that is, you know, we go to doctors and we have a lot of problems. Psychiatrists are very good at telling us what we want to know at times. And I mean, a famous example of that is ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Mm-hmm. As soon as we're told we have something, it becomes part of our vocabulary. And then some people walk around and say, look, I've got three different conditions and I might have them at the same time. But it's, you know, we can't go from having 50 references to something to having something that's the third most common disorder within 20 years. I mean, what's happening? What's the explosion today? If we look at this and we say, how bizarre is this? How real is it? There's even psychiatrists that are saying mental illness is misleading, because I've got a statement from Alan Francis. He's a psychiatrist and former DSM-4 task force chairman. That's their manual for psychiatrists.
Yes.
And he said that disorders are no more than descriptions of what psychiatrists observe people do or say. They're not well-established diseases. Mm-hmm. So they're not real diseases. So what's happening? How are people believing that these are diseases? Well, a lot of that is the counseling that they receive for it. And then, you know, and the drugs do have a certain effect upon the body as well. And, but diseases, mental diseases, there's many quotes where they do admit that it's not actually based upon facts. It's just based upon observances.
And what you're noting in, say, this explosion of references to a particular disorder, you're saying that that is it just happens to coincide at the same time as the release of a particular drug that is aimed at addressing that condition as well. And that increases the suspiciousness of what we're looking at here.
Well, media campaigns are lethal. If you have a media campaign, it's known that we can go from driving a media campaign and within 2 years, we can have an explosion of sales in a particular drug. Mm-hmm. And especially if we use celebrities, if we use well-known people within that, and then people can relate to that and say, yes, I really do have that. You know, I feel I have those symptoms. But all, what it is a lot of it is a media campaign that drives whatever we think we have to a new level.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking I encountered something a page out of a book a while back, and I'm thinking that you may have tweeted it on your Twitter feed, and it was talking about this the fact that people don't look at unhappiness anymore. They don't describe feelings of dissatisfaction in terms of being unhappy. They describe it as depression. And because we describe it as depression, this is something that can be clinically addressed. And they'll go to the doctor and they'll say, doctor, I'm depressed. What can you do for me? And they'll prescribe a pill. And there's this kind of dance that happens between the patient and the doctor in trying to address this feeling of dissatisfaction, which is completely divorced from any responsibility of the person, the choices that they made in order to cause that. They're no longer responsible for creating that problem of being unhappy. It's not because they did anything wrong. It's because of this condition. And so it seems like this is very much feeding into the trend that you're describing here, that rather than looking at our own behavior and, well, what if I did this differently, we want to put it on the doctor to fix us with us not having to make any changes.
Well, that's true. If my household is unhappy and I don't get along with my wife, I get in my car, I'm mad, and I have a car accident, and I go and see my doctor and say, look, all of this is happening because I'm unhappy. I don't know why I'm unhappy, but this is what's happening. And I need something to cope. So what's happening? Am I looking at what the causes of my unhappiness, this is just an example, but, you know, my unhappy home life, my perhaps facing a divorce, or the kids not talking to me anymore. And of course it makes me unhappy. So rather than address the situation at home, I'll go and medicate it. I'll go numb my mind with a drug, a powerful drug that creates these feelings that I'm looking for initially, but not in the long term.
Yeah.
So in the long term, we're going to create a lot of problems in our body with all these chemicals that we're playing with. And those are proven facts. I mean, go talk to anybody that's been on any kind of pill like this for, say, a year or so, and they're going to tell you they're just messed up. So you're completely right in that, that we're not addressing the problems. It's like in any other field, in exercise, it's in eating properly. Unless we're addressing the causes, we can't just go numb ourselves with something or get a pill to address that, because it's not going to work.
Can you quickly give us an idea of the relationship between these drug companies and, say, the psychiatrists and the doctors that would be prescribing some of these medications?
Oh, sure. The doctors themselves, you know, if we look at it, there's a lot of vested interests, And a lot of people don't realize that. Pharmaceutical companies, medical technology companies, and various other groups, they fund research, they support medical schools and hospitals, they advertise in medical journals. And there's also a lot of interlocking interests that run into hospital, medical, and government health advisory boards. And on top of that, the pharmaceutical industry also pays what they call opinion leaders, which are hospital and university specialists, and they pay them fees to write or speak to sway opinions, say, from professional caution about a drug to uncritical acceptance. So these are leaders paid to convince other doctors that this is a good drug, better therapy, a better drug. Now, if these opinion leaders believe that, that's great for the drug company. Unfortunately, many of these speakers are just simply drug reps with an MD. They're doing it for money, and that's a well-known fact. And I'll give you an example. There's a website called ProPublica.com, and it showed the fine line between the legitimate payments and illegal kickbacks. So openpaymentsdata.cms.gov is one site that shows how doctors receive payments from drug companies. They do have to reveal that now. And since 2013, $6.5 billion have been paid out. I mean, that's a lot of money for people to convince other professionals. And so really what this shows is that medicine is for sale to the highest bidder, but it does get worse. In 2014, there were 2.74 million serious adverse drug reactions and over 100,000 deaths. So we're talking about people talking down side effects to sell drugs. Mm-hmm. And then here's the side effects. Now, what was the punishment to the drug companies? From 1991 through 2015, there was about $35.7 billion in fines and settlements. That sounds like a lot of money, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Now, offset this with revenue. And the top 15 pharmaceutical companies made $527 billion in incoming revenue.
So $35 billion, that's just the cost of doing business, basically, is what you're saying.
That's the cost of doing business. Now, that's the value equivalent to the aggregate GDP of almost half the world's countries. I mean, it's ridiculous. And no one's going to jail. They're just getting fined. As they're getting fined and as this process is going through, they're making money again and again. However, I do want to state one other statistic that is even more stunning and that threw me for a loop. There's one source that I found, and they've sourced all the peer-reviewed studies of deaths from medical sources. And this has never been done. This is the only document of its kind. And it's called Death by Medicine. It was done through the natural health field. And I do have an article with a link to this. There was almost 784,000 deaths from all sources of conventional medicine. According to the document, that makes this makes medicine the number one cause of death in the country, above heart disease and cancer. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the method that they're using to help people. Mm-hmm. It's killing people while they're supposed to be helping them. Now, that's a stunning statistic, and I don't think a lot of people understand that.
So, yeah, that's a lot to digest. Maybe we could finish just briefly. If you could give us some your thoughts on how to avoid this trap and becoming one of those statistics.
Well, again, avoid being sick. And that sounds simplistic, but pay attention to what you eat and how you move, because your body is a fine-tuned machine, to put it in simple matters. Don't treat it like a broken-down Volkswagen. Your body's more like a Ferrari, and it needs a higher grade of gasoline than you might be giving it. So what that means is lifestyle, lifestyle, lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Change it. Change it to bring about balance. Look to add high-quality, non-processed foods. Get off the couch and pay attention to what's going on around you and who's saying what. If you're being told you need pharmaceuticals, go back to what you know. Lifestyle. Look at how to treat your body naturally. Look at the causes, like we discussed, of unhappiness, perhaps, and look to make sure that those causes are set, and then make sure that you're treating yourself and your family with a healthy lifestyle and bring about balance.
Yeah, that's great advice. I think even just to look at, with some skepticism, if you have some kind of a condition that you hear the advertisement on the television or the radio that sounds like, oh, that's exactly what I'm dealing with, and this pill promises to reverse it, really be skeptical rather than just kind of accepting those claims at face value. Realize there may be a whole lot behind that doesn't have your best interest at heart. We've been talking with the nutritionist and personal trainer Jörg Mardian about disease mongering. He's written an article about this subject. You can watch for that online at thetrumpet.com. Jörg, we always appreciate talking to you.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Good leadership is a wonderful thing. The quality of leadership determines the quality of a family, a school, business, band, organization, congregation. Good leadership is a great blessing in the lives of those who operate under it. It points people in the right direction. It inspires them to propel themselves forward. It awakens them to possibilities and stirs hope and ignites vision. It steadies the ship when the stormy seas arise, and it converts losers into winners, failures into successes. How can you improve as a leader? This is actually a subject that God has a lot to say about. In fact, he actually gave a list of do's and don'ts that will put a leader on the path to success. You can find this list in Deuteronomy 17. It's a handful of laws specifically for a king of Israel. But the direction that God provided on how the king should conduct himself is remarkably relevant and practical for an individual seeking to improve in leadership. When we think of kings, we can often think of autocrats, dictators, even tyrants. And in every country ungoverned by God, this is what they were to differing degrees. But God established something unique in Israel. There was a human king with limited authority because he actually was second in command to the real king, God himself. Go ahead and read verses 15 through 20 of Deuteronomy 17. Verse 15 shows that the king was to be a brother. There was a family tie. God always emphasizes family in connection with his type of governance. He commands his leader to treat his people as his own blood kin with compassion, tact, and sincere concern for their welfare. His authority exists not to benefit himself, but to benefit his subjects. Verses 16 to 17 warn against three common traps that destroy good leadership. First, God commands the king not to stoke his pride by amassing horses. That was a symbol of honor and stateliness and military might. It's easy for a leader to give in to pride, arrogance, and a sense of self-sufficiency. And this verse mentions returning to Egypt. That was the chief source of quality horses at the time. But scripturally, Egypt is a symbol of sin and worldliness. God had delivered his people out of Egypt in order to forge a relationship with them in freedom. So anything that turns a leader's heart back to Egypt is going to compromise his leadership. Always be alert to any business, any activity that draws you into sin. Second, God says that a leader should not multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away. It's crucial for a leader, for a man, to control his lusts. Wise as he was, Solomon's failure to obey this command was his undoing. Pursuing pleasure, gratifying the senses unlawfully or excessively, that draws a leader away from his duties and from God. And the more powerful the leader, the more his sins discourage other people from living uprightly, and that causes wickedness to spread. Well, third, God says a leader should not greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. A taste for luxury creates terrible problems. A king who has rich appetites is going to end up no longer serving those he leads. He'll use his people for his own gain. He'll impose onerous burdens on them. Solomon himself apparently fell into this trap. Next on the Deuteronomy 17 list is God's instruction that the king write out a personal copy of his law and keep it with him and read from it every day. Regular instruction in God's word and his law is crucial for a godly leader. Without it, you're going to rely on your own ideas of right and wrong, of justice and judgment, mercy and love. And a leader who's not bound by God's instructions and who uses a standard other than God's is prone to become a tyrant. This passage lists several benefits of studying God's law and word daily. It'll teach you to deeply respect God, to always view yourself as under his authority, obedient and responsive to him. It'll keep you humble in dealing with those you lead as you recognize your accountability to the great authority above you. It'll truly help you to continually conquer your own vanity and willfulness. You'll grow in your capacity to direct all your actions according to God's will. Drilling God's word into your thinking will help you maintain the right standard of conduct. And that'll bring all the blessings that come from living right and obeying the Creator, including prosperity, health, happiness for your whole family. It'll also prepare you for greater and greater rulership in the future, because it is by this law that Jesus Christ will rule when he returns as King of Kings. He will be the king, and follow his law, and you will be one of the kings. That is the greatest leadership of all. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Brent Noctegal, Jeremiah Jacques, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Winston Churchill: we make a living by what we get. We make a life by what we give. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.